This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Today, my second reading of James Prosek's book, Eels, an Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish. This book was published in 2011. Last week, I read about some of the details of this amazing fish's life, born in the vast ocean and as a tiny creature, floating and drifting to coastal estuaries, where they make their way up rivers and streams to grow and to live their adult lives inland in fresh water, where they can live for decades. There are more than 15 species of freshwater eels around the world. At some point in their lives, the adults feel the urge to migrate back to the ocean, and they somehow find their mysterious breeding site. Breeding eels have never been found. Their breeding area in the Southwest Atlantic Ocean is known as the Sargasso Sea, an area of about 2 million square miles. It's notorious among sailors for being calm and quiet, like a desert in the sea. And there are freshwater eels that are born in the Pacific and migrate to islands and areas north and south of the equator in Asia and the South Pacific. And from his website, a brief description of the author of this book on freshwater eels. James Prosek is an artist, writer, and naturalist whose work pays homage to the history of art and natural sciences while addressing contemporary environmental concerns. His diverse body of work is the result of extensive travel and field observation. Prosek creates paintings, drawings, and sculptures that evoke the immense biodiversity of our planet and its imaginative potential. The interconnectedness of nature, the ephemerality of boundaries, and the loss of cultural and biological diversity are major themes of Prosek's work. He's published over a dozen books and exhibited his art globally. Here's a part of a review I found in the New York Times in 2011 by Paul Greenberg of the book on eels. Prosek has made his reputation as a kind of underwater Audubon. His trout watercolors, collected in a book, Trout, an Illustrated History, published when he was still an undergraduate at Yale, bear those particular exciting hues that still living fish possess, the quality that fish catchers cherish. As Eels demonstrates, Prosek is every bit as good a writer as a painter. Perhaps this is because both his art and writing draw their inspiration from a similar challenge to express the ineffable, fading aspect of the natural world in the industrialized era, the feeling of bright colors slipping through your fingers. It is this quality that makes Eels much more than a fish book. It is an impassioned defense of nature itself. And so today, Chapter 2, we will visit one of the few people in the United States who are allowed to legally trap adult eels on their migration to the ocean, that done with an ancient, ingenious weir, and we will learn more of the life history of this amazing fish. Chapter 2, To the Sargasso. A November day, driving near the Delaware River in the Catskill Mountains of New York State, I follow a sign and a dirt road it pointed down. Nailed to a post in the tall grass and weeds, the sign said, Smoked Eel, and led me past the Cobbleskill Stone Quarry and a transfer station to a deeply shaded and damp hemlock glen dotted with half-naked hardwood trees. The nearest village, Hancock, on the Pennsylvania border, was run down, and its residents seemed either to have been cast out there by accident or to have been born there and stayed. Who, I wondered, had cast themselves yet further out to live at the end of this road, and what did Smoked Eel have to do with it? At every turn, when I thought I was lost, another sign nailed to a tree confirmed my way, Smokehouse. Casa de Fumo, Eel. The road became narrower and more pitted, and just as I was becoming sure that this wasn't the way, I came to a small tar paper shack with a silver smokestack perched on a high bank overlooking the east branch of the Delaware River. A man with a pointy white beard and a ponytail who resembled a wood imp hopped from the plywood door of the smokehouse. His name was Ray Turner. A gray sky threatened snow. Leaves fell and faded on the muddy ground. Highway 17 and the plaintive whine of tractor trailers seemed far away. Ray, wearing an apron over his shirt, shook my hand like he'd been expecting me. He led me into the smokehouse. There was a refrigerated counter full of smoked foods for sale. Trout, salmon, Cornish hens, and shrimp, but mostly eels that he had trapped in the river. And on the adjacent wall were photos that showed how he caught them. Every summer when the river is low, Ray refurbishes the V-shaped stone walls of the weir that funnels water through a wooden rack designed to trap fish. It takes him the better part of 4 months to complete the walls, each about 300 feet long, in preparation for the eel run that occurs during just 2 nights in September. The run corresponds with the new moon and floods brought on by the hurricane season, when the sky is at its darkest and the river at its highest. In the smokehouse, Ray took out his detailed record books, conjuring the seasons he spent at Green Flats by reading from the pages, swarms of yellow butterflies on a dead shad, storms and flood levels on the river. There were lists of things he'd caught in his trap, eels, shad, striped bass, smallmouth bass, brown trout, ivory soap, a rat, a water snake. He described the run of eels in almost biblical terms. His weir receiving the manna of the river upstream. Large numbers of eels overflowed the weir and trap, many making their way around, over, and through, headed to the sea, where they would spawn and die. "I have 3 jobs," Ray said. "This smokehouse, gutting the fish, and that stone thing out there." Ray led me down a hill behind the smokehouse to the river bank and pulled a canoe out of the tall grass. He instructed me to do the same. "Those flatlanders," Ray said in his direct military way of speaking, "summer people, yuppies, come up and buy a place here and get a canoe, tie it to the bank. They don't understand the concept of a flood. You know what happens when their canoes tear free? That's right. They float down and end up here. I've got 6 or 7. Never bought a canoe in my whole life." We paddled each in our own canoe from Green Flats upstream to the weir. Ray kneeled in his canoe, staying tight to the near bank. With his long beard, the hills of the Catskills and the rusty yellow foliage of beech trees behind him, he looked like an old Russian bush guide making his way up the Amur. Truly he was an anachronism here, a 2.5-hour drive from Manhattan. In this broad valley, reminiscent of a 19th-century painting of the Hudson River School, the weir made an impressive piece of land art. It seemed to change the landscape itself, make the mountains more majestic and the sky bigger. Ray spoke of it in metaphorical terms. "This is the womb," he said as we tied up the canoes and stood perched on the rack. "Those are the legs," he gestured toward the stone breakwaters, stretching diagonally on either side of the river. "You see, it's a woman. All the river's life comes here." I looked at the stone walls of the weir, built every year by hand, that coax the river into the trap. Ray was careful to explain that the weir is not a dam. Water percolates through it, over it, and around it. The trap itself, or rack, looked like a hermit's shack that washed down the river and got stuck here, made of plywood and 2x4s, erected and taken apart every year. Like a polite host embarrassed by an untidy home, Ray explained that this weir was 2 months past being in tip-top shape, and the wooden rack was about to be disassembled, the parts stored in his basement. As the river moved through the slats, the rack collected all kinds of debris, leaves and branches that Ray removed with a rake as we talked. He explained how the eels get pinned underneath the overlapping ramps, unable to fight the force of the water coming over the top of them. Ray shared the physics and hydrology of his weir and trap, putting to use his training as an engineer in the Army. There are two wings of stone, as you can see. We waded into the water above the weir. On the inside of the V, the walls were steeper and chinked with lots of small stones and quarter-sized gravel. On the outside of the weir, the walls sloped more gradually and were covered with beautiful flat paving stones that fit together like puzzle pieces. Ray was intimate with every large stone. Some were so heavy, he admitted, he needed the help of three or four friends to move them. A few of the biggest ones were granite sidewalk slabs from the village of Hancock, dragged there by horses on a stone boat in the 1920s. A large rectangular stone that Ray moves back into place every year will be his tombstone when he dies. All summer in the low water, I'm working on the weir, Ray said. I get some help from a 15-year-old named Jamie and a few friends, but other than that, it's all me. All of this was in preparation for a handful of nights when Ray's yearly catch was made. How do you know when the eels are going to run? I asked Ray. I say what my brother used to say when he was a bear guide in Alaska. Look for signs. A few days before the run, a number of large eels show up in the trap, one here, one there. Then the next day, 10, then 40, then 100. Ray calls these early fish the vanguard eels. The storm that triggers the run could be 1,000 miles away, he says. A hurricane may only just be hitting the Gulf Coast, and it's sunny and clear on the Delaware River, but the eels know it's coming. The eagles show up and get agitated. It's close to the new moon. Days later, the rain comes and the river level rises. The water gets off color. And if all this happens within 2 weeks, either side of September 27th, the eels run. Everything has to be ready. He can get over 1,000 eels a night, a ton in 2 days, 100 in an hour. He fills the canoe with eels and brings it down to Green Flats, dumps the eels in the tank by the smokehouse, paddles back up to the weir, fills it with eels, brings it down again. All night I'm going, Ray said. Ray is one of just a few individuals on the entire Delaware River system who is permitted to operate an eel weir. He inherited the right to build it from his father, Ray Sr., who had inherited it from his predecessor, Charlie Howard. You can't really say he inherited the weir itself, because like every human structure, it is to a certain extent fugitive. In fact, it was abandoned for a number of years until Ray revived it. Every year, he repositions the stones into walls using manpower and ingenuity, and every winter, the ice and floods take them down again. I believe that work is a privilege of life, Ray says. On old topographical maps, the location of Turner's Eel Trap is marked Eel Weir Hollow. There has been a weir there on the east branch of the Delaware River for at least a century, and it is likely that Native Americans had an eel weir at the same site, or at a site nearby, for thousands of years before. Back atop the rack, we stood and stared up the river at the V formation of flat water ahead of the walls. A braid of water about 6 feet wide slipped into the rack like a lacy veil, then splintered through the wooden slats, forming a frothy waterfall beneath our feet. I stared upstream at the force of all this water coming toward us, and I got scared, a genuine feeling of fear. The river is a formidable thing to tame, I said to Ray. We're not here to stop the river, Ray said. We're here to catch eels. That's our creed. If you're trying to stop the river, it just shows how stupid you are. From the top of the rack, we had a view of the changing light over the river and hills. The trees and the Japanese knotweed on the sandy riverbanks had lost their leaves. Ray pointed overhead. "There's Baldy," he said. As I looked up, I saw a mature bald eagle fly low over us and land in a tall tree on the far side. Ray began again to rake leaves that had got caught in the slats of the rack. "When I'm catching eels, there's four or five of them here," he said of the eagles. "I see them every day. It's nothing for me." "Up here," he said, "it's me and God and that woman's singing." He gestured toward the river, the woman he was speaking of. "It sings to you with a splash and bubble. When the flatlanders have gone back south and the eels are migrating, most of the time when I'm harvesting at night, there are no lights anywhere. But the Big Dipper on the night of the run is framed by the hills there, just downstream. I love building the walls. The harvest is hell." Back at the smokehouse, Ray showed me the two concrete block chambers where the eels, dressed in brined and salt, brown sugar, and local honey, are hung on rods. Behind each smoking chamber is a 55-gallon drum stove with a door on the front and a chimney hole with two pipes in the back. Once the fire is going in the stove, Ray directs the heat and smoke into the chamber, and the eels are cooked at 160 to 180 degrees Fahrenheit for a minimum of 45 minutes. The hot smoked eels are sold to passers-by, as well as to restaurants and a few retailers. Ray keeps some for his own eating. "Always check the product," he declared. "I consider the eels to be the best quality protein in my line, a very unique flavor of fish, applewood smoke, and a momentary lingering of dark fall honey. All the fish I smoke, trout and salmon, are farm-raised, except the eels. The eels are wild. They're like free range." Ray ushered me through the back door of the smokehouse, past neat stacks of hand-split applewood, to a large wooden tank, like a giant wine cask cut in half, covered in moss and dripping water through its swollen slats. I peered over the chicken wire around the rim into a clear, dark pool. Ray stirred the water with a net, agitating some 500 dark silver eels, most about as big around as silver dollars and up to 3 feet long. They were lithe and sensual in their movements, just magical. "Every year," Ray said, staring into the black water, "I let the biggest girl go. When I finish this year, she's free." He pointed. "Nearly 5 pounds. He and I clung to the tank edge, mesmerized by the dark fish writhing in the bottom. I wanted to glimpse Ray's world again. I wanted to see the run. At the end of the day, we retired to the warmth of Ray's home. Snow began to fall outside. "First snow of the year," he said, petting his dog named Smell. "Yet I don't like these gloomy days." He contemplated his work while making me a hot chocolate. Ray seemed keenly aware of the ephemeral nature of our lives on Earth, of the rigor of building a wall, watching it get knocked down, and building it again. "It's amazing that a man would do work," he said, "knowing that his work is never complete. I live out here 'cause I want to. At the end of the road." He sat down and rolled a cigarette, using a book to support his hands. "I've seen people come to the head of the driveway, take one look, and turn around. I know what they're thinking, that they just stepped onto the set of Deliverance. Those that are brave enough to step out, I tell them, this isn't just a smokehouse, it's an adventure. Most people come, they see the smokehouse, they see the eel tank. You're seeing it all. For you, it's a journey." And that's the end of my reading of the second chapter of the book called Eels, An Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish. I've been looking at maps of the Delaware River, the longest undammed river in eastern United States. Imagine the shape of New York State. The river starts in that crook in the bottom line of the state. It flows south and forms the border between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And at its end, It widens and flows east past Cape May, New Jersey, into the ocean. Cape May is a place I haven't been to, but I'm very familiar with it, being a birder. Cape May in fall is famous for its concentrations of thousands of hawks and songbirds, affected much like the weir that concentrates the eels in Ray Turner's river. The birds concentrated by landforms at Cape May, they reluctantly, finally fly over the open water as they must go on south. They fly over the broad Delaware River estuary, and under them, under the water, making their way out to the sea, are the eels, pushed on their hidden, powerful need to get to the open ocean. This image in my mind of this weaving and movement of life stirs my soul. Next week, another reading from this book. I want to mention an event coming up in April, April 2nd, Tuesday. Abby Church from Mississippi Valley Conservancy will be giving a talk, part of the Valley Stewardship Network Terrific Speaker Series, Conservation on Tap. She'll be talking about conservation easements, one of the most powerful ways to preserve land for future generations. So be sure and mark your calendar for April 2nd, 7 o'clock at the Fortney Hotel in Viroqua. I hope you can make it. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.